and commercial and otherwise, is absolutely necessary if we're going to start recreating some respect for the global operating system that did so much for us.
I would only add the observation that defending ourselves economically must also move into other more specific directions rather quickly as well. During the Cold War, there was a famous organization called COCOM that united United States with our NATO allies and a few other countries. And it was largely successful in denying the former Soviet Union access to a great number of cutting-edge technologies developed in the West that allowed NATO and the United States to maintain a relative military technical superiority that was a large part of our ability to deter the former Soviet Union. It is long past due that the United States lead an effort to revive a COCOM-like organization in some manner to promote far greater coordination amongst the democracies in controlling and, if necessary, denying Chinese access to technologies developed in the West that it is using in a very highly developed and systematic way to bolster, build up its military capabilities. The Chinese policy of civil military integration is very pervasive. A Communist Party leader giving a speech in a city or a medium-sized town usually mentions civil military integration, and there are requirements for local organizations, whatever they are, whoever they are, in assessing their ability to contribute to China's military might under the rubric of the civil military integration policies. We haven't even started to defend ourselves from the Chinese vacuum that has been operating almost unimpeded around the world. Just a short anecdote, about a decade ago, some sources, Russian sources, mentioned that they decided to completely stop China's use of foreign deployed students to obtain Russian research, military research at Russian technical universities. They decided they had enough, and they just stopped inviting these students. I've not had this confirmed by other Russian sources, but it's an example that you can do this and not suffer great consequences. The payoff is worth the effort. Thank you.
All right, with that, I'll walk into the floor. So again, if you can please identify yourself.
Hi, yes, my name is Vlad Fidon from the Victims of Communism and the World Foundation. First off, thank you all for the talk. My question is regarding the Great Zone conflict with China. What are some U.S. policies that would help to counter their actions in the South China Sea, specifically using their fishing boats to swamp Japanese territorial waters and island building? Thank you.
It's very much an art and not a science. One of the principles that I would think would be useful is responding asymmetrically so we don't set up a confrontation that puts us at a disadvantage or something we're not prepared to do. One of the things that I think would be very useful right now, with North Korea having profoundly changed the status quo, and I for one believe that they already have a nuclear weapon, our intelligence community, despite its great skill, is usually a little bit behind reality in assessing North Korea, because North Korea is such a bloody difficult target to be able to penetrate. Let's assume for the moment that North Korea does have a nuclear weapon. If we're not going to enhance and reinforce our land's capabilities now, when are we going to do it? China appeared to be much, much more irritated by the South Korean adoption of the theater high altitude area defense system to protect themselves than they were of North Korea's achievement of ballistic nuclear missile capability. That gives us a clue where we can go here to start pushing back. Given that Japan is well within range of North Korean missiles since August 31st, 1998, to be precise, when North Korea shot a Taepodong missile over Honshu with no warning. Enhancing Japan's air and missile defense yesterday would be called for, and we can tell the Chinese that if you can't or won't help us to restrain North Korea, then we have no choice but to reinforce our alliance capabilities. It's not about you, it's about our allies, and it's about U.S. vital interests, and we're going to do this. On the deterrent part, there is deterrent by fear of punishment. We think that's pretty well covered by the U.S. nuclear arsenal, but much, much more effective, I submit, is deterrence by denial. If we can add to the surveillance capabilities available to Japan and the Republic of Korea so we can detect missile launches even 20 seconds earlier than we do now, then we have a geometrically increased chance to defeat a North Korean missile when it's at its most vulnerable, when it's in the ascent, otherwise called the boost phase. So these types of things, I think, are necessary. The Chinese depredations in the South China Sea and what they've done to the ecosystem there, I think, have achieved virtually zero attention. None of the big-time environmental non-governmental organizations that I'm aware of have been much bothered by this. We are missing a chance here to put ourselves on the side of the angels and set up a very large, very effective maritime surveillance system around the entire South China Sea. And no, this is not aimed at the PLA Navy. This is aimed at policing fishermen so that we can make sure we preserve the fish stocks in the South China Sea. Transparent, but nevertheless, it's an asymmetric pushback, and it also puts us on the side of the angels of working to protect the environment that China has so egregiously worked to destroy with their mining of the coral there. Interestingly, the only agency I can find that's done anything to publicize what China, the damage China's done, is the BBC. They did in-depth analysis. They had people not on the ground, on the water out there filming Chinese actions as they were grinding up the coral. This needs to be brought up. Last, I think we are guilty of pulling our punches on human rights. North Korea runs probably the world's worst gulag system. China imprisons anybody that speaks out about rights in China, etc., etc. We ought to be more vocal about this. We don't necessarily need to become one-note Charlie's on this, but to let this all pass without any comment while we compliment the diplomatic reception that we get when we go to Beijing is missing the point, and it's sitting there in a card game and refusing to play our aces. Our brand around the world is human rights. We played it well in the Cold War. And we need to start thinking about how we play this again. Not to be cynical about it, but to protect people and protect folks that believe in representative government like we do. And in many ways, I think doing some of these things would help to bolster Taiwan's status and not eliminate some of the dark clouds that they're seeing develop all around them in East Asia.
Do you want to add something, Bob? Regarding the South China Sea, I think one of the most powerful assessments of Chinese intention that I have heard was given at a Capitol Hill briefing by my organization several years ago by Dr. Phil Carver of the Potomac Institute. Phil had completed an exercise in which he had access to PLA historical research journals that had recently been given permission very, very late in the game to evaluate the Japanese campaign that nearly succeeded in taking over most of East Asia in 1940-41. Great number of articles were produced in this journal, and at the end of these journal articles, as per the format, the Chinese military author was allowed to comment on the mistakes that were made by the Japanese and how to do it all better. Well, Phil was able to take all of these conclusions and put together a map showing a potential invasion campaign by the PLA of most of Southeast Asia. Very impressive. It's not something that has made its way into the annual Department of Defense report on Chinese military developments, but perhaps it should. Perhaps it should have made its way a long time ago. That's just on the information level of how to begin to do something that we've made some progress in doing, but not nearly enough, and that is demonizing China's activities, China's offensive and threatening activities. And beyond that, well, I have no problem in arming our allies sufficiently to deter China. We have complicated relations with our ally in Manila the best of times, but at a certain point, given what we know about Chinese intentions and what they've done to fulfill those intentions so far, it certainly would be in order to simply gift the Philippine government 100 or 200, 300 kilometer range ATACMS surface-to-surface missiles. If the Chinese have intentions of invading Palawan and other Philippine islands, well, it's certainly incumbent as an ally to help the Philippines acquire capabilities that could interdict such a threat. And a couple of hundred ATACMS missiles would certainly raise the price of PLA military operations from their new, newly constructed bases in the Spratly Island group.
All the way in the back, sir.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smith. In reporting on the electrical blackouts in Taiwan back in August of 2017, Reuters figuratively described this as Taiwan's power vacuum. And with the dearth of domestic energy resources in Taiwan, it's estimated that Taiwan imports 99% of its energy resources, including uranium from the United States and South Africa, and fossil fuels from many other countries. It's been suggested that this crisis in Taiwan's energy needs is really a national security crisis. And I wonder if any of you could comment on how you think this could be addressed, either within or outside of the parameters of the Taiwan Relations Act. Does the United States need to play a role strategically in helping Taiwan resolve this issue? And also, does the PLA, do you see any threat to disrupting the supply of energy resources to Taiwan?
Yes, like Japan and South Korea, Taiwan is very vulnerable in terms of maintaining its supply of external petroleum. It has little petroleum resources of its own, and drilling for petroleum in the Taiwan Strait or close environs runs you into complications and trouble very quickly. As has happened for the Filipinos in the South China Sea. There's not an easy solution here. They are dependent on the ability of the United States Navy to maintain open sea lines of communication to ensure petroleum deliveries. In Taiwan, nuclear power is very controversial. Opposing nuclear power is a very closely held, long-term policy position of the ruling DPP. There are occasional critics in the West who express the view that, well, here now, there's a practical side of all this, as you've mentioned. But the Taiwanese will settle this as they determine, and they likely settle it in the ballot box. But this is not all. News is not all depressing, and I'm not putting on my tin hat here when I tell you about the near miracle that Lockheed Martin has been telling us about for about 2 years now. They've recently revealed patents that they've taken out on a contained nuclear fusion generator that can fit within the confines of a normal shipping container. Now, this is not some crackpot inventor. This is most years our top defense contractor, which has hired senior, respectable, highly educated engineers who say they can do this. The impact of such a capability would not only potentially make Taiwan nearly blockade-proof, of course, it would upend the oil-based economy of the globe and put the United States in the catbird seat in terms of deciding how this technology would be distributed and who would get it. Now, we're not the only country that is working furiously on fusion. The Chinese have invested mountains of money in this and have even entered into a number of large cooperative programs to achieve the breakthroughs necessary to achieve fusion energy. But if Lockheed basically can put it on the back of a tractor-trailer truck, with each truck being able to power 80,000 homes, at least as far as Taiwan goes, there's possibly some very good news in the future.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. I'm Mike Conte. I'm the director of the DPP's mission here. A couple of points. Yes, it's true. Taiwan is very vulnerable on the storage, on the energy front. But it knows that. DPP government knows that. DPP government is committed to ending nuclear power generation in Taiwan. The Fukushima incident brought everybody's attention even more forcefully into the question of the fact that Taiwan sits on, the generators sit on a lot of earthquake potential spaces. Tsunamis are not beyond the realm of possibility in Taiwan. So there is a problem. It's a huge problem. The DPP is committed to generation from alternative energy sources. Now, it's clear those are not going to cover the need fully, but they are looking at the problem. And I think in addition to wind and solar, there's a question of storage capacity, which has been a major issue across the board. And I think Taiwan's technical capabilities will come into play there. Hopefully, more storage, larger storage capacity will make the energy that's available from wind and solar more available across the board. So I'm not trying to be Pollyannish here. There is a problem, and it's going to be met significantly. I think the DPP is committed to that. Whether they'll be able to pull it off, that remains an open question.
Any other questions or comments for our panelists? All right, well,
oh,
yes. Over here. Yes, please.
This, I'm Yoshi Kumaru, the Japanese newspaper, If I may digress a little bit from the Taiwan issue per se, General Gregson mentioned that planned deployment of Aegis ashore for the year 2020 in Japan as something insufficient or too tiny, or something along that line. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the reasons for your concern for the current plan.
I think North Korea will constitute an even greater threat to Japan long before 2022, and with North Korea's recent actions, I think it's incumbent upon the United States and our allies to do something to show the Japanese people and the Korean people that yes, we are concerned about your safety and we are taking action. The idea that I mooted about additional surveillance, perhaps with unmanned systems that can detect missile launches much earlier than we are now, does not negate the value of Aegis ashore. Aegis is a wonderful system to defend an island, an archipelagic nation made up of 6,852 islands, if we can believe National Geographic, stretched from the tropics to frozen Sapporo. But with the threat today, we need a response in the very near term so that the Prime Minister can show the Japanese people that he's not just waiting for the Americans to solve this or something, or not outsourcing the problem. It's a matter of showing North Korea that we're responding and providing a credible threat that we will deny North Korea the capability to hit Japan. And I think that if we can take Kim Jong-un's threat and make it moot because we can defeat it, I would consider that a big plus for the alliance in deploying these additional capabilities to Japan and to the Republic of Korea and to the rest of the region might have an effect on other people too besides North Korea. We've stunned them into silence.
Yeah.
It's time to retreat.
Well, Yoshi, as well, you know, the latest version of the Standard 3 missile, co-developed by Japan and the United States, now in production, the production of that missile could potentially be ramped up. They could be stored in launchers ashore and could be directed by Japanese naval Aegis systems that already exist. That certainly could provide an additional capability before the formal Aegis ashore could be developed. So there are also options well within Japanese budgetary and technical capabilities to respond to the North Korean threat.
Yes, sir.
My name is Alex Gurman. I'm a security policy studies student here at GW. My question is for Ms. Glazer. Regarding Washington's role in increasing Taiwan's capacity in the international community, do you believe the onus should be more on Congress or like-minded American NGOs to increase that participation? Thank you.
I think there's a role for both to play. I mean, there's a role for the executive branch to play. There's a role for Congress to play. There's certainly a role for other NGOs to play, for foreign governments. Governments should all be protesting to Beijing when Taiwan is excluded from important meetings. And that includes not just things like annual meetings of the World Health Assembly, but there are technical meetings of the WHO that Taiwan is excluded from. When it comes to UNFCCC, you have Taiwan's usually NGOs that participate there. Certainly other civil societies around the world can underscore the importance of including Taiwan and their contribution that they make and then the cost of excluding them. So I guess I'm reluctant to assign any particular weights. I think that there are many actors that that have the potential to speak out on Taiwan's behalf, to organize meetings and include Taiwan and tell the PRC, if you want to come, fine. If you don't, that's okay, but we're including Taiwan anyway. So, I mean, there's so many different ways of doing it, and more the better, I guess.
Last week in Chile, I was told by a contact that within that government there was some interest in the American Taiwan Travel Act. It appears that many other countries share the disquiet and are uncomfortable with being forced into constraining their relationship with Taiwan as Beijing demands. And they're not just looking for leadership, but they're looking for encouragement. They're looking for an example to follow in terms of if they, for larger national reasons, have to change their relationship between Taipei and Beijing, or need some encouragement in adjusting their relationship with Taiwan in a more positive direction in order to obtain benefits from there, trade, cultural, what have you. So the clear message is that when the United States improves its relationship with Taiwan, other countries take notice. And when we make major statements or make major changes, like Taiwan Travel Act, we should broadcast it, and we should be ready to talk it up when our officials and our members of Congress go abroad.
All right, with that, I think we've come to the end of our session. So if you'll help me thank our panelists for what I can only characterize as a shock and awe. We have tea and cookies for high tea and a half an hour break. But beforehand, if you can just help me thank our panelists.
Frontier.
Usually, this much.